Maybe you've seen it on a driver's license application. The choice of whether or not to become an organ donor in the event of your death. Sounds like a noble thing to do, right? What could go wrong? Well, as it turns out, lots.
I was unable to move, to speak, to open my eyes, but I was fully conscious and aware of what was going on around me. I heard multiple footsteps coming into the room and one male voice saying, this one's a sad case. Young woman, two small children at home, her husband is being completely unreasonable. If he would just sign the forms, so many people could benefit from her organs.
Organ transplant industry is a multi-billion dollar industry. The organ transplant industry is larger than the abortion industry.
So in my experience, patients are being given the diagnosis of brain death or there's no hope. They're not even giving patients a chance to heal.
Could healthcare providers be over-eager to harvest organs from a donor whose prognosis is less than certain? Today, you'll hear firsthand accounts from both healthcare professionals and former patients whose lives were at stake for this very reason. Life Issues presents End of Life, Who Gets to Choose? A special program for Sanctity of Life Sunday and beyond. With your host, the president of Life Issues Institute, Brad Mattis.
This program may change the way you view end-of-life issues, specifically a doctor's determination of brain death and the surprising realities of organ donation. Stay with us for an in-depth look at critical issues you and I will ultimately face. Jenny Hammond was a registered nurse for 12 years and is a former executive director of California Nurses for Ethical Standards. Her desire to become a nurse began 30 years ago when her life almost ended. Jenny had a history of small epileptic seizures, and in 1985 she contracted giardia and was treated with Flagyl. This medication is contraindicated for patients with central nervous system disorders. The first dose caused a grand mal seizure. Jenny's husband was unable to wake her the next morning, and she was later declared brain dead.
Were you aware he was trying to wake you?
Yes, but I was unable to respond. And he called 911. They took me to the hospital, and they said, we can't get the seizure to stop. And they were pumping me full of the drugs that they give, which are neurosuppressants, meaning they lower or suppress brainwave activity. Finally, I coded. My heart stopped. My breathing stopped. The next time I was aware of anything, I was in the ICU. I was unable to move, to speak, to open my eyes. I was what they call locked in. But I was fully conscious and aware of what was going on around me. There was one nurse I remember very well. She would speak to me every time she was in the room and let me know what she was doing, why she was there. She called me by name. There was another nurse. I came to recognize her footsteps, the little sounds that she would make, but she never spoke to me until one day I heard her voice. Would somebody come in here and help me move this thing?
Seriously?
Seriously. She called me this thing. I was a piece of meat. I was a burden. Time was hard to judge. I had awake times and asleep times. And when I was awake, I understood everything that was going on. But I wasn't always awake. I did have sleep time. And one of the awake times, I heard multiple footsteps coming into the room. And one male voice saying, this one's a sad case. Young woman, two small children at home, her husband is being completely unreasonable. If he would just sign the forms, so many people could benefit from her organs. You can't have my organs. I need my organs. There was another voice spoke up and said, Doctor, is it appropriate to talk like this in front of the patient? He said, hello, she's brain dead. She can't hear anything. She doesn't understand anything. There's nothing there. She only has about a 1% chance of coming out of this coma. And if she does, she'll be a vegetable.
So your determination was pretty strong at that point, I'm
pretty
guessing.
Pretty strong at that point. It was less than a week later I came out of the coma.
Jenny was in a coma and on a ventilator for 3 weeks, and it was a long road to recovery once she woke up. After her experience, Jenny chose to become a nurse with a passion to compassionately care for people who experience situations similar to her own. She believes patients with brain injuries and brain death diagnoses are not necessarily dead. Instead, families and patients should be afforded hope, time, and a right to basic care.
I'm not an expert on at what point is a person truly dead, but I don't believe that brain death is true death. However, I do think that there are cases of people who simply will not recover from brain injury, but that brain injury is not necessarily the same as death. And even if the brain is not functioning, if they're able to breathe on their own and they're not respirator dependent, then their brain is still functioning.
Angela Clemente spent 20 years working in the medical field in the pathological and clinic lab and the ER. She spent the past 17 years as a paralegal and forensic intelligence analyst. Her findings have been cited during multiple congressional investigations, including the Jahi McMath case. Several years ago, Angela's mom was hospitalized and diagnosed with endocarditis, an infection of the heart. The hospital chose to medically manage instead of aggressively treat her mother. As her mom's health steadily declined, Angela and her brother were called into a meeting with the hospital ethics committee.
They told us, well, they're in here to help you guys understand what's going on and to make things work better for, you know, between the hospital and you guys. And I said, okay. So I'm thinking, oh, great. You know, it's somebody that's going to negotiate and listen to what we have to say. That is not what an ethics committee is for. That is not their agenda. We started having a bombardment of nurses and doctors and internists coming in and asking, do you really want your mother in pain like this? You know that she's suffering. She's suffering like this. She's suffering. Would she really want to be on a respirator and trying to do this guilt type of, you know, intimidation? I did not know that if there's a conflict, if you have, say, two other brothers, if one of them, and a lot of people don't know this, this is key and very, very important for families to know, if even one of them is not in agreement and thinks, well, maybe she's suffering, maybe we should let them go, that is instant. That's all they need to hear. And then legally, they can take over. If your mother or father, if they don't have something in place saying who's going to act on their behalf, and the family does not all say the exact same thing, ethics committee can step in and take over. Then you're done. The family has no more say-so. Luckily, me and my brother were in agreement at all times. We knew that Mom wanted to live.
Angela's mother slipped into a coma and the hospital pushed to diagnose her brain dead. But Angela took steps to advocate for her mother's wishes. She called in a doctor and personal friend for a second opinion. He believed her mother was not brain dead, but that her ammonia levels were too high due to the narcotics, causing the coma and low brain activity. Angela also received word from a friend at the hospital who knew her mother wasn't being cared for properly.
She said, I walked in when they were changing your mother. Your mother has a decubitus ulcer, big bed sore, in other words, on her sacral area, the butt bone there, the size of a dinner plate, and it's down to the bone with the muscle and bone exposed. So I called in Adult Protective Services. I noticed they're pushing me on signing off on her last 60 days, lifetime reserve days. These are something that Medicare has. When you run out of your Medicare money and you have nothing left, there is a little reserve there called the 60 lifetime reserve days. And you get 60 days of full treatment. They just took it without me signing off on it. They took the 60 lifetime reserve days. I called up Medicare and I said, we've got some fraud going on. They took my mother's lifetime, 60 lifetime reserve days. And according to you guys, they can't take that without my signature or without my brother's signature. They said, really? So they started their own investigation.
The hospital gave Angela 8 days to move her mother. And on the third day of that period, her mother woke up. She was cognizant and reported hearing the conversations about her brain death diagnosis.
She woke up. Medicare fraud had stepped in. We got her transferred to the Mayo Clinic up in Jacksonville. She survived. The hospital had to give back $236,000 back to her lifetime reserve days.
Coming up, we'll hear surprising truths about the organ donation process.
You're listening to a Life Issues radio special, End of Life, Who Gets to Choose? With your host, Brad Mattis.
Dr. Paul Byrne practiced medicine as a neonatologist and pediatrician for 55 years. He's currently the president of the Life Guardian Foundation, an organization that works to protect, preserve, and defend life from conception to its natural end. Dr. Byrne is an expert on brain death and works to inform people about this troubling diagnosis and how it differs from true death.
You can have almost any definition that you want for brain death. All of the laws are around the absence of brain function. An absence of the functioning or the function doesn't mean that the brain is destroyed. When a physician observes an absence of the functioning, it doesn't mean that the function is gone. Like my automobile right now is not functioning, but the function isn't gone. All it does is take a key and a driver, and the function is there. And that's the way that medicine is. So an absence of the functioning does not mean that the person is dead.
Not accepting the brain death diagnosis, what, in your opinion, is the definition of death?
Death, of course, is when the life is absent from the body. We should not be declaring people dead until we are as certain as we can possibly be that the soul is separated, that the life is gone. No one should be declared dead unless there is destruction of at least the three major vital systems of the body: the circulatory system, the respiratory system, and the brain. And then that determination should be made in accord with generally accepted criteria.
Teresa Dampf is a former EMT driver and has worked as an ER and ICU nurse since 1998. Throughout her career, Teresa has sat in on multiple presentations from organ procurement organizations regarding the brain death diagnosis. After educating herself on the facts, Teresa learned the subjective nature of the diagnosis and how the criteria can differ between doctors and hospitals.
There is not a complete criteria for brain death. There's no law that says this is what brain death is. When I became an emergency room RN, we had to stay after our shift and listen to a representative from one of the procurement companies from California. He said, "Does anyone have any questions?" I said, "Did you say that a person has to be 100% brain dead in order to be diagnosed as brain dead?" And he says, "Yes, that's correct. That's what I said." And I said, "Well, isn't it true that, let's say, 50% of your brain is injured and the other is not? Can't you still be diagnosed as brain dead?" And he said, "Well, yes, that's true. Technically, two doctors can declare someone brain dead, but they typically will do these tests."
Accepted medical standards can be whatever the doctor says, can be whatever the hospital says, can be whatever the American Neurological Association says, but they can be different according to a different doctor. But to just use accepted medical standards makes the criteria for brain death to be the weakest of all laws.
Bobby Schindler is the brother of Terry Schiavo and the president of the Terry Schiavo Life and Hope Network. While Bobby believes in the good that can come from organ donation, he also cautions people to educate themselves and challenge the brain death diagnosis.
I think they need to do their diligence or due diligence and educate themselves on this whole organ donation program. I think it can be a good thing, so to speak, but I think it's been corrupted. There are situations where a person can use the organ donation program to help. It can be helpful. But I think people have to be very careful and really do their best to educate themselves on whether or not they want to be an organ donor.
Lucrative financial outcomes can be a factor in determining a brain death diagnosis. Long-term care can incur high costs for hospitals, and many patients declared brain dead are perfect candidates for organ harvesting, a procedure that financially benefits the medical community.
I think hospitals might see that this person is going to be in this type of condition for a prolonged period of time, and they might be quote-unquote expensive. So they look at this as being very costly and therefore are going to try to do what they can to convince the family members to take the steps to end the person's life.
Angela,
what do you think is the incentive of the hospital to declare somebody brain dead so that they can harvest their organs.
Financial. I have to have a transplant. I'm waiting for a transplant. I'm ill. I have a liver issue that if I don't have one, I'll die. Just my surgery alone, I've already been quoted $500,000 just for the liver. So can you imagine if they get a patient's body that gives the corneas, gives, you know, a heart, gives a lung, and they don't give the patients time enough, it's generally around 3 days, unless the family fights it. They want those organs within 3 days.
Organ transplant industry is a multi-billion dollar industry. The organ transplant industry is larger than the abortion industry. Many dollars involved. I've seen estimates that someone who is brain dead is worth $1 million. A heart is worth $1 million to a university.
Dr. Paul Byrne has seen an increase of the diagnosis as a means for organ transplantation, and he fears not enough people are aware organs must be harvested from a donor with a beating heart.
Brain death, of course, was invented. They had started to do heart transplants, but they realized that they were not successful unless they got the living donor. Every heart that is transplanted is a beating heart that is stopped first and then taken out for transplantation. The heart without oxygen in 4 to 5 minutes is so damaged that you can't transplant it. The liver, likewise, in 4 to 5 minutes is so damaged that you can't transplant it. So they have to get these organs while they have circulation.
Would you say that most people think that the organs are harvested in the hour or so after the person officially dies?
Of course. Who would think that they would be taking organs from a living person? It's written on our hearts to protect and preserve not only our own life, but the life of people that we love.
Teresa Damp.
They are taking you breathing with your blood pumping, with everything functioning, and then they cut out your organs. So in my experience, patients are being given the diagnosis of brain death or there's no hope. They're not even giving patients a chance to heal.
This is a Life Issues radio special, End of Life. Who gets to choose? With the president of Life Issues Institute, Brad Mattis.
A silent and deadly epidemic is moving across our country. Diagnoses of brain death have been steadily increasing over the past several years. Decisions are being made by medical professionals regarding the life and death of patients, sometimes without the family's participation. So-called brain dead patients are often dismissed as too expensive to keep alive and beyond hope. But families need to remain strong, be patient, and hold on to hope for their loved one's sake.
Jenny, what would you say to a family whose family member has been diagnosed with brain death and now they're contemplating their choices?
There is no true standard for diagnosing brain death. It's very subjective. One doctor's opinion of brain death is different than another. You cannot necessarily trust a diagnosis of brain death as being truly dead.
Bobby Schindler.
Our family should be afforded every opportunity to get second opinions. If they're in a situation where they can offer that loved one some type of rehabilitation and therapy, they should be afforded that opportunity. Whatever the situation might be, ultimately, the families or the guardians that are making these decisions should be the ones that have the final say in what happens to these individuals.
Teresa Damp.
Educate themselves on the truth, because unless you really understand what this is all about, this brain death criteria, what's the history of it? Where did it come from? Why is it happening? What's the financial benefits of it? Unless someone really knows, whether you're a medical professional or a lay person, you really can't advocate for someone very well beyond just, you know, trying to stand your ground and say no, no, no.
And Bobby, it seems like the prevailing message here is it takes a long time for the brain to heal, so be patient.
We're seeing now where we're finding more research where the brain is actually can heal itself. To simply write a person off as a brain injury and say they're never going to improve or be in their best interest to just end their lives, I think we're making a terrible mistake. It's very easy to simply say, oh, they're not going to get better, let's just end their life, let's just kill them. yes, the hard decision is to care for these people, but it's the right decision, and it's a decision of compassion and love. And it's really a reflection upon us, really as a nation, how we're going to care for our most vulnerable.
Through the work that you've seen with Terry's Network, have you seen a trend in the medical community where they're turning more away from valuing human life and preserving it to instead ending it?
Without a doubt. It seems to me decisions are being made with what is in the best interest of the hospital rather than what is in the best interest of the patient. So every day we're seeing it more and more where patients' medical rights and families that are advocating or trying to protect their loved ones are being eroded more and more every day. And there's been a shift where these hospitals, these ethics committees, these doctors are now in position or have the power, so to speak, to make medical determinations and whether or not a person is going to receive these types of treatments rather than family members. So you have strangers now making decisions where families once were making decisions with what was in the best interest of the patient or their loved ones.
Angela, how can a family challenge a diagnosis of brain death?
There's a couple things that they can do. A couple things that they should not allow to happen. One is they'll ask them to sign for an apnea test. The apnea test is to see if they can breathe on their own after a certain amount of time. It's going to be within those first, 3 days. So that brain has not had the time to heal, and because of that, they know that that apnea test is going to come back very poorly. Also, the apnea test can cause more brain damage. Don't sign off on the hospital's advanced directives. Get your own. Have an attorney. Put in there that you reject the brain death diagnosis. So when you enter a hospital and you have those documents, or someone, your family has those documents for you, they know right off the bat you're rejecting that. And you're not going to allow them to do some of those tests that are going to damage the brain worse.
Bobby Schindler and the Terry Schiavo Life and Hope Network are working to provide practical help for families who are dealing with the trauma brain death diagnoses bring. This is a life and death issue plaguing patients across the country. Families and medical professionals have the authority to advocate for loved ones and ensure that every person is valued and given the best chance for treatment and recovery.
We've been in existence now for over 10 years, and during that time, we have just a huge network of resources. So we have physicians, we have attorneys, wherever the person might be throughout the United States. We've been very successful in finding them the help that they need.
How can medical professionals and family members be advocates for patients?
They have to know their rights. Many times these families or whoever it is advocating for loved ones don't know their rights and the things that they can ask for, certain types of treatments that they have every right to provide for whatever it is the situation might be with their loved one.
Jenny, as a nurse, how would you advise medical professionals and family members to advocate for patients?
We first have to build a relationship with the patients and their families, because nurses are the most trusted profession out there. And without that relationship and the trust, we can have no influence whatsoever or have a negative influence. So if we want to have a positive influence, first we have to build the relationship. Second, we have to be honest, even when it's risky for us to be honest. And it is risky.
Well, we're seeing this whole quality of life mentality, I think, permeate our healthcare system today. Decisions are being made that are in the best interest of the hospital's bottom line, rather than what's in the best interest of the patient. We've been involved in cases where, and know of cases that if a person is just given time, given a chance at rehabilitation or therapy or something, does improve, and does improve significantly. When someone experiences a profound brain injury, it doesn't have to be a death sentence. We have to do what we can to change that paradigm and get people to understand that these people, more than anything, need ongoing and constant rehabilitation and therapy. We saw in my sister's case where they were saying, well, no rehabilitation is going to help her. There's no therapy that was going to improve Terry's condition, which is completely contrary to all the evidence that's coming out now when it comes to people with these types of brain injuries, like similar to Terry's. So people need to educate themselves. They need to learn more about brain injuries and how these people can be so helpful to us to learn more how to not only treat people with these types of brain injuries, but to also care, love them, and show the compassion they deserve.
Once again, your host, Brad Mattis.
In the aftermath of this program, we hope you've come to the realization you need to give careful thought and consideration to end-of-life decisions without procrastinating, especially regarding the issue of whether or not to be an organ donor. As Bobby Schindler emphasized, it's not always a bad thing to do, so long as you plan carefully and watch for dangerous pitfalls. As was mentioned earlier, a good advanced health care directive is vital. It's an important part of any estate plan. We prepared these free resources to get you started and to educate you about your rights. Please request them to share with friends and family members.
To get the resources Brad just mentioned, visit the Life Issues website at lifeissues.org, where you'll also find many other helpful pro-life news stories and resources. That's lifeissues.org. Together, as followers of Christ, we can shine the light of truth into a world that so desperately needs to hear it. And friend, thanks again for listening to this Life Issues radio special, End of Life, Who Gets to Choose?